The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You are listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 18th of January 2022 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I am Markus Hippi. Coming up on today's programme, Germany's Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock touches down in Moscow. But just how crucial is Germany's role in determining how Europe will react to Russia's aggression? We'll have the latest from the ground then.
This year's World Economic Forum takes place in the shadow of an enormously difficult period for economies, for people and for the planet.
Strong words from UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres as leader strayed Davos for a virtual meeting. Also ahead, our Asia editor James Chambers has an update from the region, including how Macau is set to renew casino licenses for the first time in 20 years. Plus, Brazil's booming pet industry. What is this all about, Fernando?
Hi, Marcus. Brazil is already the second largest pet shop market in the world, and I'll tell you why the numbers are keep getting better.
Indeed, more from Fernando a bit later. All that and more ahead here on The Briefing with me, Markus Hippi. We start in Russia. German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock is in Moscow today to meet with her Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov. This is without a doubt a high-stakes meeting as tensions continue to rise over Ukraine and the West's response. I'm joined in the studio by Chris Jermuk, Monocle's news editor, who has been following this story. Chris, stay with us because first we'll be crossing over to Anna Nemtsova, who is the Moscow correspondent for Newsweek and the Daily Beast, and she joins us today on the line from Kiev. Anna, you are in Kiev, and that is where Baerbock was just yesterday. Did her visit there make any waves?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Everybody was discussing her statements, and it was important for Ukrainians to hear that she was not accepting Russia's point on Ukraine's sovereignty. No country has the right to dictate to other countries which direction they may take. That is an important message from her for Ukrainians. She also promised that she would go to Moscow and convince Lavrov of the Kremlin to revive the four-way Normandy format negotiations, which last time took place in 2019. So the last time Putin met with President Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, was almost 3 years ago. Ukrainians living on the border with Russia and Belarus are now expecting tanks any minute. And this is, believe me, psychologically extremely important to know that at least somewhere, some diplomats are trying to stop the tanks. I was right on the border with Belarus and Russia yesterday when the Belarusian leader announced there would be a huge military exercises next month. And I was at an award, cancer award, where children having treatment and they have blood cancer. Their parents have a war in their life already, and they cannot even think of dealing with evacuation, thinking where to move their dying kids to. So there's a lot going on in Ukraine right now where people on the border, especially in the border regions, both in the south and on the east and in the north, are very worried about the threat that is hanging over their heads.
Anna, looking at that, looking at this meeting or these meetings, do you think they have the same gravitas in Russia, for example, as they seem to be having for Germany?
I think it is an important message today from the foreign minister of Germany that there is no alternative to good relationships with Moscow, that that is seen as at least there is somebody from the West who keeps coming to Moscow and who is playing a role of sort of a mediator between United States, between Washington, London. Because if you see the world with Moscow's eyes, which I've been trying to do for the last two decades, the Kremlin is convinced that Washington is pretty much running Ukraine. So when they look at Kyiv, they see Washington. And when they see a German foreign minister come into Moscow, they think there is at least somebody they can convince they have a point. But at the same time, they hear from the foreign ministry that there is absolute consensus in G8 and in NATO about Ukraine's future and Ukraine's choice.
Anna Nemtsova, thank you very much for joining us. Now, still with me is Monocle's Chris Jermuk. Chris, Sergei Lavrov and Annalena Baerbock have spoken today and they're giving a press conference as we speak. What has been said so far?
They are literally giving a press conference as we speak on this show. I've been listening a little bit just ahead of this program. I think there's a lot of things you could say about this. This is a high-stakes meeting, as you say. What's interesting, first of all, on that is the fact that so far much of the attention has been, of course, on US and Russia and what sort of can be achieved in that environment. What this press conference, what this meeting of Annalena Baerbock was about, she was in Ukraine yesterday, she's in Moscow today, is sort of trying to reassert Germany's role in this process. It has a historic role in this process, particularly, of course, under Angela Merkel, who was very close with Vladimir Putin and was seen as a strong sort of interlocutor in this whole process, even when other countries were not perhaps able to reach Vladimir Putin. She was able to. And so this is sort of the start of Annalena Baerbock trying to reassert a German role in this. And what you heard during this press conference, first of all, the positive, if you will, was that both sides, Sergei Lavrov and Annalena Baerbock, committed to talks. That in itself is significant. They both stressed the importance of continuing to talk. They also both stressed the importance of what's called the Normandy process. And this is sort of a negotiation group between Germany, France, Russia, and Ukraine. This was actually the sort of negotiating group that was active before this recent crisis, if you will, that took place with Russia amassing troops on the Ukrainian border, which has, as I said, sort of refocused attention on the U.S. and Russia as well. The last time that the four leaders, Germany, France, Russia, Ukraine, met was back in 2019. So in that sense, it is significant that both sides recommitted to the Normandy process. Sergei Lavrov tried to even sort of speak to Germany's role in this and say that it's up to Germany to try and convince Ukraine to have some movement and recommit to the process and stop, in his words, sabotaging the Minsk peace process and the Minsk agreement. So Lavrov was sort of leaning a bit on Germany there. And Annalena Baerbock, for her part, is just stressing that she is somebody who can be a negotiator. This is a very high-stakes mission for her as the new German foreign minister. So her point was basically throughout this and in this press conference to say that the relationship between Berlin and Moscow remains important. She is offering herself as somebody who can be crucial in these negotiations, who can play a role in these negotiations along with France to try and reach some sort of resolution.
So no breakthroughs, but at least discussions continue, which is good news. It's interesting that the focus has been so much about the United States and Russia and now Germany and Russia. But what is the role of the European Union and Brussels at the moment?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, what's interesting is that perhaps also in that sense, to describe some of the difference in Germany and the new government, with Angela Merkel in charge before this, she really was such a key figure. And so she was sort of the key negotiator, if you will. And the European Union did not play as much of a role, if you will, in this process. If you now look at Annalena Baerbock and what she has said, she has stressed even in her meeting and in this press conference with Sergei Lavrov, that what she is trying to do and what her role even is to uphold the EU's common values, and that the EU should be taking a role in this as a united front, a united negotiator. She stressed that almost more than even NATO, for that matter, and the NATO military alliance. She focused on the fact that the European Union has to uphold its common values when it comes to speaking to Russia, and that the EU should take the key role. And this is something that has been part of her foreign policy also, for that matter, in a whole bunch of other issues as well, to really stress the primacy of the European Union and that Germany simply plays a role within that process. So it will be interesting in that sense to see going forward, even though, as I mentioned, she talked about the Normandy process with Germany and France, whether she sort of tries to include the European Union and its negotiators more in this process as well.
Chris, the Ukraine crisis has proven to be quite an early test for the new German government, hasn't it? How confident is Baerbock when she heads to these discussions now and tries to mediate between Russia and Ukraine?
It's interesting to watch her, I have to say, for that reason, because she, you know, she stressed she wanted this foreign policy portfolio. There are some other sort of heavyweights, if you will, in the new German government who have foreign policy credence, whether that's Olaf Scholz, of course, the chancellor as well. But she is trying to be the one who really takes a lead in these discussions. It's not an easy case for her, as you say, for the German government as well. What's been particularly interesting, I think, is that she has been towing this fine line ahead of, if you will, ahead of the German elections, when the Greens, Annalena Baerbock, we should say, of course, is a member of the Green Party. The Greens were quite strident in their talk about Russia, also talking about things like opposing the Nord Stream pipeline, for example, with Russia. This was one of their election pledges. That has now been reversed. So it shows you, in a way, how tricky this line is and this crisis is for the German government. And to figure out exactly what role they play, one of the things that Annalena Baerbock said also in the Ukraine was that on the one hand, solidarity with Ukraine in this crisis. On the other hand, Germany will not offer defensive weapons to the Ukraine. That's not part of course, their history. And they will also continue with the Nord Stream pipeline. And that was quite a significant step for her to say that, to say that the Nord Stream pipeline is important. In this press conference today, she also talked about the importance of energy, renewable energy contacts with Russia. So it's a very significant crisis for Germany, but it's also interesting to watch Annalena Baerbock try and stress the importance still of a relationship with Moscow and Berlin, as well as a relationship between Kiev and Berlin.
And just finally, what happens now after today's discussions?
Well, I think the most significant thing in that sense is that both sides talked about perhaps working towards a common meeting of the Normandy group, so reviving that Normandy process. That we'll have to listen to the rest of the press conference, but that will be interesting to see if something comes of that, if there is going to be more of a meeting and a shift perhaps back towards this kind of negotiating group between Germany, France, Russia and Ukraine. And in that sense, also more of a direct contact once again between Russia and Ukraine rather than Russia and the United States and this sort of high level that we've had in the last week between those two superpowers. So I think that will be the key question at this point. Are Russia and Ukraine going to sit down with the European Union or with Germany and France to try and reach some sort of resolution?
Chris Jermak, thank you very much for this update. And now here is Monocle's Tom Edwards with the day's other news headlines.
Thank you, Marcus. An airstrike has killed at least 14 people in Yemen during strikes in the capital Sana'a, launched by the Saudi-led coalition fighting the Houthi group. It follows an attack claimed by the Iran-aligned Houthis yesterday on coalition partner UAE in Abu Dhabi, in which three people died. The strikes appeared to be the deadliest since 2019 on Sana'a. MEPs have been gathering in Strasbourg this morning to elect the next president of the European Parliament. There are four candidates in the running, but it is anticipated that Roberto Metsola of the European People's Party will win the vote. Before his death last week, Parliament President David Sassoli was due to step down under a deal struck between parliamentary groups. Tonga's small outer islands have suffered extensive damage from a massive volcanic eruption and tsunami. New Zealand is trying to send clean drinking water and other supplies, but ash cloaking the runway has prevented aircraft from landing. Two people have been reported dead so far, but there are fears the true toll could be far higher. And the London Short Film Festival enters its fifth day today as miniseries, TV shows and blockbuster movies continue to dominate our screens. It's refreshing to see a celebration of this often overlooked format. You can read more about this year's edition. Head to monocle.com/minute. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Marcus.
Thank you very much, Tom. Now, the World Economic Forum kicked off yesterday, but sadly, instead of taking place in the Swiss mountain town of Davos, where executives and world leaders have regularly gathered, it's all virtual this year, taking place online. Rob Cox is global editor at Reuters Breaking Views, and he has been following this year's discussions. Rob, good afternoon to you. Now, this event takes place online again. What is that doing to the dynamics and significance of the event?
Well, I mean, look, this last 2 years has shown us that Davos, at least as it's known, the World Economic Forum in Davos, is essentially a networking event. So it is, yes, it is a place where world leaders come and they give speeches and there are panels with lots of worthy CEOs and NGO leaders. And we're seeing that. I mean, you have the Prime Minister of Japan, Fumio, today, the Prime Minister of Israel. You had Xi Jinping yesterday speaking. But in a virtual setting, it's completely different. It doesn't quite match for pound for pound what the World Economic Forum offers to all of these world leaders and change makers and policymakers when they get out there every year at this time.
Now, what are the big themes this year then? What is discussed online?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. I mean, I'm not sure anyone's really following it to the extent that they do. I mean, in the past, right? I mean, so certainly getting out of the pandemic, you see that for sure. The Davos agenda in general, you know, the sort of today, for instance, they're talking about renewing a global social contract, meeting the challenge of vaccine equity. So, you know, it is clearly, you know, the questions that humanity is facing of the day. The issue is that, you know, anyone can kind of pull together lots of people speaking online, having people then kind of discuss those or tackle some of those issues in person. That's really what's missing here. And I talked to a lot of CEOs and people like that who were really raring to go this year. I mean, they were really pumped. And I went into it, I don't know, let's say 3 months ago when the climate event, the COP26 was happening in Glasgow. Part of me was thinking, oh, this event is going to steal Davos's thunder, right? Because all these people are going to come under the aegis of the United Nations to save the world, to save the planet, to reduce global carbon emissions. And therefore, no one's going to want to go to Davos in January. But actually, what I found was people were even more interested because while high-level big decisions might be made at UN-type conferences, they say that when they get to Davos and they talk to their fellow Davos men and women and CEOs and that kind of thing, they actually put the building blocks. They kind of actually take these big ideas and think about ways to move forward, whether it's deals or partnerships or introducing my people to your people and that kind of thing. And that's lost when you don't have the networking event, no matter who you might get on the dais or on the podium with His Honor Klaus Schwab sort of nodding his head in agreement with whatever is being said by whatever prime minister might be there.
So certainly lack of enthusiasm there about this year's edition of the forum. Does it really serve any point at the moment then? What are your thoughts about what's happening this year?
I mean, look, I think any opportunity where people are getting together, and real, you know, leaders are on panels and things like that, it's somewhat helpful, but I can tell you just as a journalist, it's nowhere near at the level of interest. We have people monitoring it for sure around Reuters, of course, and then my team at Breaking News, we're kind of keeping an eye on it, but it's not game changing. It's not in the way that usually with Davos, you do come away with some sense of where we're headed. Now, of course, people talk about how the Davos consensus is always wrong, or even some of the sort of bank types or CEOs you talk to, they say, okay, here's the Davos consensus. We should bet completely against this happening. But at least there, what you have is this consensus developing. I think it's really hard when you're fragmented, when you're online, when you don't have interlocutors who are really pressing the interviewers or when you just have people like, again, the Prime Minister of Japan getting up and delivering speeches. It's just not the same.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, Rob, I know you've been to Davos quite a few times, and this is indeed the second year in a row when world leaders haven't been able to hit to the town of Davos. I'm wondering, how reliant has that place become off this forum, and what's happening there when the highlight event of the year is not taking place?
Well, there's no traffic on the promenade, so that's, I suppose, some locals are quite happy. You don't have lots of Audis and EVs and cryptocurrency Lamborghinis and things driving around. So it's probably quite a pleasant time to be in Davos. Now, if you own a place in Davos, you're smart enough to rent it for 8 to 10 days at $50,000 to $100,000. Franks, you're probably not happy about losing that opportunity to do so. But Davos will come back. I mean, while I was skeptical a year or so ago, I actually think that the Davos as a place where people meet, where they network, where they strut their stuff, that kind of thing, is there's always going to be a demand for that. And as long as the pandemic is quelled at some point, I think the town and certainly the World Economic Forum will come back. I think what it's just shown is that without that human touch, without that personal ability to network, that the World Economic Forum is not quite anything like as powerful, or let's say as influential in its agenda setting as it has been.
Mm, exactly. I think we are both looking forward to an actual face-to-face version of,
the Davos. There's so much pent-up demand for that.
Absolutely.
There really is.
Rob Cox from Reuters Breaking Views, thank you very much for joining us today. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. We turn to Hong Kong now, where our Asia editor and bureau chief James Chambers is standing by. Good evening, James. What has been in the headlines for you today?
Well, just listening to that report on the Davos being a bit of a ghost town to Hong Kong, where the tourism board has just released the figures for arrivals in the whole of last year in 2021, when the borders in Hong Kong were pretty much shut. And surprise, surprise, in the whole of last year, we saw about 91,000 people come to Hong Kong. And that's down from a staggering 65 million in 2018. So it's been a bit of a drastic shutdown of this city, and that those kind of figures just put it in numbers.
Absolutely. What does it mean for the life of Hongkongers not basically any of those visitors, really? For example, the hospitality sector, how devastated is it at the moment?
I mean, it's been devastating for a lot of businesses involved in tourism. A lot of the tour guides and those kinds of small businesses have been hit particularly hard. A lot of the hotels have, had seen a massive reduction in overseas visitors, but they have bounced back to a certain extent by offering staycations, and they have far, far deeper pockets. I mean, we just saw a story come out yesterday where the Kadori family, which own the famous Peninsula Hotel, they've used this opportunity to, when the share price is down, to increase their shareholding of the Peninsula. So they now own up to 70%. So whereas the big hotel groups have struggled, they do tend to have deeper pockets. But it's the smaller businesses involved in tourism that have suffered the most.
What is also the feeling amongst the public over there? Do people actually miss tourists?
It's a strange one. It's not as clear-cut as you might think. Of course, there are a lot of jobs that depend on the money that comes in from tourism, whether directly or indirectly. But it's not like we go out on the street and you've noticed that 65 million people have suddenly disappeared. Hong Kong is still a very crowded place. There's 7.5 million people living here in very dense conditions. It's not like, one, you've noticed the difference on a day-to-day basis. The MTR, the subway is still very packed. Restaurants are packed. But there are certain parts of Hong Kong who have been enjoying it because they're the types of neighborhoods which would have seen a lot of tourism come and a lot of people dragging their suitcases around. So for them, they have been enjoying a bit more space, a bit of a quieter time. So, you know, I'd say after 2 years of this, the local people aren't really clamoring for the borders to reopen because, first and foremost, they are still as scared now as they were at the start of this of catching coronavirus. You know, the government has done a pretty good job of keeping Hong Kong COVID-free, and that is, you know, top of people's minds.
Sticking to the theme of COVID, China is now encouraging people to stop ordering parcels from abroad. Tell us more.
Yeah, so we all know that you know, Beijing will be hosting the Winter Olympics early next month. And, you know, China and the Beijing government have been laser focused on making sure that the games go ahead and we don't see the same kinds of issues that that happened in Tokyo and saw the Tokyo Olympics, the Summer Olympics, postponed. You know, they're taking such drastic measures as they're now banning, you know, even local people from attending the games. It'll only be by invitation. But as part of this, these kind of draconian measures, they've now recommended that residents in Beijing stop ordering anything from overseas, any packages or, you know, any kind of shopping, because Beijing discovered its first Omicron case just recently. And the authorities reckon that it came from a parcel that was ordered from Canada via the US and Hong Kong to a lady who was living in Beijing. Now, there are experts outside of China who doubt that. It's something that the Chinese authorities have repeatedly claimed to be the source of many infections, especially when they can't trace the source. And a lot of the experts say, while it is possible, and we have seen it in Hong Kong in a few cases, it's very unlikely to happen with the frequency that China seems to report. So they will keep, you know, obviously a very close eye on all these things, but they are saying that, you know, people can help assure a COVID-free games by cutting down on their overseas ordering.
Now, one more news story we have to cover. Very interesting announcement. Casino licenses in Macau will be renewed in June this year. How much excitement is that causing?
Well, Macau, you know, it's a place that we don't really hear about that often. And that's largely because there's not much there other than gambling. It is the only place in China where casinos are legal. And so it's a huge magnet for Chinese gamblers. Now, for decades, this chap called Stanley Ho had a complete monopoly on gambling in Macau, but his monopoly was broken up in 2001, and that was the first time that they issued licenses to other people, including some of the big Vegas names. Now, those licenses were for 20 years, so those were the first licenses ever granted, and they're coming up for renewal in June. So this is a huge event for Macau, and everyone was looking at how these new licenses would be framed and whether they would be amended and changed. And I guess the good news for the six casino operators in Macau are that it looks like there's not going to be much of a drastic reform. The new licenses won't be for 20 years. They will be for 10 years. But the effect of that might be that the incumbents actually are the only ones who bid for these licenses again. Because if you're going to build these huge resorts in Macau, you want to know that you're going to get, you know, 20 or 30 years to recoup your investment. So if it's only 10 years, there are unlikely to be any other players who are trying to enter the market. So even though this could be seen as, you know, the government trying to restrict or restrain the operators, actually the market and investors has reacted very positively to this. The American casinos with their Asian branches listed on Hong Kong Exchange, all three of them saw a bounce on last Friday when the news was announced. So I guess this is being seen as by the market as a very positive thing.
Monocle's James Chambers in Hong Kong, thank you very much. You are with The Briefing on Monocle 24. And finally, in this program, we are going to look at Brazil's pet industry. The country is the world's second largest market for domestic animals, behind only the US, and almost no street goes by without a pet shop in sight. And Monocle's senior correspondent and resident Brazilian Fernando Augusto Pacheco joins me in the studio to tell us more. So, Fernando, you were in Brazil recently. Tell us more about what's happening over there with the pet shops and animals.
It is crazy, Marcus. I think if you've never been to Brazil, you'll be surprised of how many pet shops there are. And it is an industry that keeps on growing. We are already the second biggest market, as you've said, just behind the United States. But think about it. Brazil, you know, first of all, our population, you know, is lower than the US, and we're not as rich as a country as well. But, you know, look at China, look at India, look at here in Europe as well. It's such a strong market, and people love to pamper their pets. In fact, I was looking at the biggest chain of pet shops in the country. It's called Pets, with a Z, I have to say. They have 168 stores. They're planning to open 50 in 2022, Marcus. And their shops, I have to say, they're like shopping centers. They're not just your tiny little cozy shop. They're huge. You can buy literally everything you want for your dog, from an acupuncture session to some nice clothes as well.
Well, I've been looking at your list of the pets you've had in your life. You've had a couple of dogs. One of them was called Master Mister. The other one was called Katharina. You also had a rabbit called Veridiana and a chinchilla called Blue. We may have to talk about Brazilian naming conventions.
Yeah. But all my choices, I have to say.
But before that, tell us about how much people are spending money on their pets. Do people ever consider saving money and maybe buying something for themselves rather than the pets?
And that's what I find so interesting, Marcus. Brazil is going a little bit, we're in the middle of an economic crisis, and the prices for pet food, they have increased 24% last year. Even with the case that I just told you, people are still spending money on their pets. And I have to say, if you ask me, is it something of a social class or of a state? No, I think this is throughout the country. It doesn't matter if you're poor, middle class, if you're rich, if you're from São Paulo or if you're from the Amazon region. It doesn't matter. People are spending money with that. And I am surprised indeed, because people are making quite a lot of savings, I have to say. It's been a difficult few years in Brazil. But that area, the pet shops, they are as stable as ever, growing, in fact.
Tell us more about luxury things you can buy for your pets. What do you come across in Brazilian pet shops then, if they are particularly well stocked?
It's funny that I mentioned acupuncture as well. It's not a new thing, acupuncture for dogs. I mean, it's there. But in Brazil, I mean, I was in the middle of certain conversations. It comes so frequently. People say, oh, my dog acupuncturist. But they said as if it's just going to the bakery to buy bread. Mm-hmm. I mean, in that sense, I was very much surprised. I personally think they pamper a bit too much, perhaps. I do have a dog, Julie, a beautiful German Shepherd. I mean, she doesn't need to dress in lovely clothing. I did buy some premium treats for her as well.
Right.
Again, the word premium is there. I'm a Brazilian. I can't deny. I am attracted to those kind of... If you say it's premium for my dog, probably I'll go and buy it if I have the money.
I remember there was one pub in London that also launched something for dogs. And one of the things they offered was Prosecco, some kind of a sparkling meat liquid. I wonder if you can get anything like that from Brazil.
Yes, you can. And Marcus, even I mentioned pet shops, of course, but if you go to a normal supermarkets, there will be a pet session there. And it's much larger than what I see here in the United Kingdom, for example. You mentioned Prosecco, yes. And there are a lot of, how do you say, the vitamin things you have. The
supplements,
smoothies.
Yes, smoothies.
Which I hate, but there are a lot of smoothies
for dogs.
Well. Yes. It's there. Again, Julie is not having those. She's having lovely treats. And there are special pet food for specific types of dogs as well. Perhaps that's common, but you know, there's one for German Shepherd, which I think that's the one she's eating.
I have to ask one more question, because I've been hearing these amazing insights of the Brazilian culture from you, Fernando. So we've talked about this a few times on the radio, that bakeries are a flirting ground for young Brazilians. I wonder if pet shops serve any function such as that.
Don't quote me on that, but I believe we do have love hotels for dogs as well. So, I mean, we do have love hotels for people, but I think we have one for dogs as well. I mean, in case your dog wants to find a nice partner.
How do they work?
I mean, I do have to do a full-on investigation on that for you, Marcus, because I haven't been inside one. Is it a good idea? Good for them, good for the owners. It's a good investment if you invest with your in pets in Brazil.
We clearly have to talk about this another day as well in this program. Fernando Augusto Pacheco there, thank you very much. And you can read Fernando's full piece on Brazil's pet industry by heading over to monocle.com/minute. And that's all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Carla Torrebello and Chris Jermuk. Our researcher was Lillian Fawcett and our studio manager was Christy Evans. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time, midday here in London, 7 a.m. in Toronto. I am Markus Hippi. Goodbye and thanks for listening.